W is going to be one of the biggest airdrops of all time. Definitely one of the biggest this cycle. And so that's going to be a lot of value being dropped to Solana users that they're definitely going to go and use to speculate on other things. So I'm curious to see how these airdrops affect the ecosystem, what people are going to be bidding with their newfound capital, how well these assets trade. I'm pretty excited overall.
Before we get into today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in this episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. All right, let's jump into the episode.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of 0x Research. The Blockworks research team is back again to bring you another episode of an analyst roundtable. Today is Monday, April 1st, and we are joined by Westy and Effort Capital from the Blockworks research team to jam on the latest market happenings. As always, you can use code 0xresearch10 at app.blockworksresearch.com for 10% off your annual Blockworks research subscription. Ren, do you want to kick us off this week with some news and governance updates?
Yeah, of course. I think the first big news of last week was that CCTP goes live on Solana, went live on March 26th. I think traditionally, bridging to Solana from EVM or any chain really hasn't been the best experience. I think most people either have to use like some shitty bridge or they need to route through a centralized exchange. So CCTP going live on Solana feels like a relatively big unlock, to be honest. And CCTP has done a whole lot for the Cosmos ecosystem, more specifically DYDX through Novo. And maybe we'll see the same, but it also does feel like that most people that wanted a reason to be on Solana had one already. They weren't waiting for CCTP to bridge there. But yeah, there's been a few early integrators, notably Cube and Drift, and I'm sure CCTP.money will have Solana integrated if it hasn't already. So that's super exciting for Solana. Congratulations to them. Something else on the slightly more governance side of things is that Arbitrum Foundation's grant program is moving to phase three. This is going to open on April 15th. It's focusing on dApps and has like 40 different tracks, whether that's like RWAs, dev tooling, DeFi, DPIN, infra, NFT, social, basically anything that's a dApp, to be honest. So if you want to go build an Arbitrum, you know, you should probably check it out. I'm not sure how much money is being given out, but it does seem like a relatively big grants program. The next news and governance update is that Sonic SVM, which is basically they're going to launch like a modular SVM chain built to enable sovereign game economies on Solana. It really feels like they're focused on the whole gaming thing, whether they'll be able to compete with like Arbitrum, since it seems like gaming is kind of Arbitrum's thing at this point, will remain to be seen. They have this thing called Hypergrid. You're free to use any game engine of choice, and it's a multi-VM ecosystem powered by the Hypergrid interpreter. But I'm going to take a pause there. Anyone have any thoughts on CCTP, Arbitrum grants, or this Sonic SVM?
Yeah, touching on the Arbitrum grants piece, I think we're really going to start to see a lot of these L2s begin to focus on specific niches. And I think this is sort of a good way for Arbitrum to feel out which niches are probably best suited for that chain. I know they've been really focusing on gaming recently. They also are pretty big in the perp space. So I think those are two that I think we know Arbitrum is really good at. Maybe they find another niche they didn't know about. But I really think like a lot of these L2s are going to begin to narrow their focus and be less general purpose and have specific niches that they nail down. And this is one, I guess, step towards that for Arbitrum.
Yeah, I'll just be interested to see like how effective some of these spends are, because like obviously, you know, you need structure, you need KPI reporting, like there's just a lot that goes into it. And when you have like a very large sum of money, it's almost difficult to deploy that amount of money. Like you even see it with Optimism. They have, I think it's $750 million of OP incentives they're handing out over the next, you know, season of RGPF. So definitely a lot of work left to be done here, but nonetheless, I think using these tokens to actually incentivize development is a 10 out of 10 idea.
I think it's interesting. I feel like at this point of like Arbitrum and Optimism, the app developer shouldn't need any external incentives or funding to build within an ecosystem. Like hopefully at this point, I know like we're so in the grand scheme of things so early to everything, but it feels like for Arbitrum and Optimism, like you shouldn't have to rely on like these grant programs or external incentives to get developers to burden your ecosystem. And I think that partially shows in Optimism's decision to rename their thing from like retroactive public goods funding to just retroactive funding instead of like just public goods. But yeah, we'll see. And like Arbitrum also has that $400 million gaming fund that's going through like the DAO proposal process and in the forums. I don't know whether that'll pass or not, but I don't feel like you should be doing too many grants, to be honest. It seems more so like a BD slash branding game at this point for Arbitrum and Optimism specifically.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing they need to be careful of is Arbitrum, like Foundation and DAO is seeming to spend a lot of money recently. And especially with the first STIPs as part of the DAO, they didn't really do a great job in like figuring out KPIs and what kind of spend worked. And we're going into, I guess, the LTIPs, the long-term incentive program. And I hope that, you know, they don't continue overspending on certain things and they figure out where money is best spent. So yeah, that's just one thing they need to keep an eye on.
Yeah, moving on to a few other news and governance updates. One notable one from last week is Ritual's partnership with Celestia. Basically, same as everything else, Ritual's going to plan on using Celestia as its DA layer for the Ritual Superchain. Another thing, which I might get Alpha Capital in here to explain a bit more, is partial set security in the Cosmos. Basically, eigenlayer in the Cosmos LAN, which sets the stage for permissionless shared security, whereby validators can opt into any consumer chain to validate. And then just a few small minor ones to close us off. Prisma Finance underwent an exploit last week. I don't know how Prisma has been doing, to be honest, for the past God knows how long, but I'm sure the token price was down only since it launched. And then One Intro, which is a liquidity bootstrapping protocol on Solana. I think this one's relatively interesting. Sure, I get that a lot of dApps, developers, whoever, don't want a huge amount of liquidity for the token, given that it results in token prices pumping easier or faster. But I mean, like just looking at like Slurf and whatever ridiculous amount of liquidity it has, probably north of 100 million today. It's like pretty crazy seeing something with that much liquidity on chain. And yeah, I think there's an argument to be made for some protocols, like you should have increased liquidity on chain because if you don't, it bars some like large holders or institutional holders from like allocating towards your token. But that's a super long discussion. And the last news and governance update of the week is that Uniswap has a proposal for deploying on Say, and a vote is alive for funding a treasury management council with 6,000 UNI. But I'll stop there. Anyone have thoughts on all of those?
I'd like to get Efrit's take on the partial set security. It seems like ICS 2.0 for the hub, is it?
Yeah. So I guess the best way I can explain it is the Cosmos Hub launched interchain security last year. It was like the long-awaited feature upgrade for the hub. Pretty much like the entire purpose of the hub from day one was really supposed to be the shared security network or provider for the entire Cosmos ecosystem. And then ICS V1 launched, which is replicated security, and it put the burden on governance, token holders, and the validators as well to decide what consumer chains, which are effectively like AVSs in eigenlayer world, what consumer chains did the hub want to, you know, provide security for. The problem is it creates like adverse selection. The governance token, the token holders, yeah, token holders really don't know exactly like what is a good AVS or good consumer chain or what isn't. And once a consumer chain got approved, passed through governance to be secured, it forces all 180 validators in the active set, big and small, to support a consumer chain. Some validators are making hand over fist in terms of from atom inflation, so they'd be happy to support new chains. There's validators lower in the active set that just like don't have the you're not getting enough commission in order to actually support an extra chain. It adds additional OpEx, got to run a new binary, maybe you have to hire additional DevOps. So it kind of created like this permission shared security feature that I think was a good V1, but it limited, I think, the potential for what the hub could be. When you look at Eigenlayer, like one of the beautiful things about Eigenlayer that everyone's so bullish on, it creates this like permissionless shared security marketplace. Validators and ABSs are competing for really like ETH security, which you can say is like this this scarce commodity. What this ICS 2.0 is, this partial set security, it's the exact same thing. It's actually the first version of restaking, permissionless restaking out in the wild that we're going to see prior to Eigenlayer launching, I'm assuming sometime in Q2. So validators get to decide what consumer chains they want to secure. a consumer chain pretty much submits a transaction to the hub. And then I think, I don't know the exact mechanics yet. It isn't live, but I know there obviously is the governance proposal that is being voted on right now. But validators get to opt in or opt out to secure a consumer chain. So, you know, theoretically, you could see a bunch of current Cosmos chains start leveraging the hub security. They can lower their overall security budget by, you know, 25 to 50, but I'm sorry, lower by like 85 to 75%, depending. It's just going to create like a competitive marketplace for the hub security offering. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how much demand is there for Atom as like the security backstop for the Cosmos ecosystem. So really bullish on this. I think the, you know, getting away from the hub leaning on on-chain governance, even though on-chain governance, I think, is its one, you know, one of its strongest suits. And there's certain areas where governance is probably needed. I think letting the hub, letting the free market decide like what the demand there is for Atom security is a really big bullish catalyst for the hub. So I'm really excited to see that launch. There's a couple other, you know, things going on in the background to start bundling other services on top of shared security, because shared security by itself is going to be commoditized service offering in the long run. So I think a lot of people are really understanding how far ahead in terms of like thinking about the shared security marketplace the Cosmos Hub is compared to a lot of the hot new topics like EigenLayer. But yeah, I mean, long-winded answer to say like that it really just is a permissionless shared security offering.
I have a quick question for everyone here. Something I just like randomly thought about over the weekend. basically, I think you've seen tweets that say like stuff like shared security, EigenLayer, or whatever, decreases the opportunity cost of restaking, right? Because you already have that like native ETH staking yield. And so like whatever else you're providing security to doesn't need like as much yield as you would have had to like emit it had there like been no native ETH restaking. And I thought about it, like, sure, I kind of get that. But then I thought about it a bit more. I was like, wait a minute, that makes like zero sense. You are taking, say, like an additional like 20% of your collateral, like slashing risk. Why is the fact that you're having native ETH staking yield like decrease the amount of compensation you need for that extra amount of like 20% slashing risk you take? It should still be the same whether you were, there's like native ETH restaking or not, no?
Preach. I feel like I've been speaking, yelling into the void about this. Like, I think that's the biggest meme that's being propagated all throughout like crypto spaces, that because ETH is already a yield bearing asset, that it's going to lower the security cost for all ABSs. If I'm an ETH staker, which I'm not today, but if I was an E3 staker and I was putting up my like blue chip yield bearing asset that might about to launch like an ETH ETF and become like this next institutional grade crypto asset, like I am not going to be restaking my ETH to get like 0.001% yield on that for restaking, you know, an ABS that probably doesn't find product market fit. It's not worth the risk. And this slashing risk is actually some of the issues that Cosmos Hub community has already gone through, because there was almost a major slashing event for two validators for the Cosmos Hub, but governance kind of stepped in and removed that slashing risk because it was like a very specific niche issue. But I 100% agree with you, Ron. I think that's like a big meme that's being said. I don't believe that that's the case. I think that there's a lot more ETH capital that's trying to chase yield, and there's a lot of ABSs that are not going to be able to offer that yield. What's going to end up happening is liquidity mining, but security mining. ABSs are going to pay a shit ton of money to attract ETH restaking. And then the moment that well dries up, operators and those delegates are going to move on to the next ABS. I'm not bearish on EigenLayer because I'm fundamentally bullish on this idea of shared security. But I think like that specific meme is probably not true, even though it's been propagated a lot by like very big brains in the space.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything Effort said. You need to evaluate each ABS on its own set of risks and return, because it doesn't matter that there's like a backstop of yield, because each ABS gives you a certain percentage basically of you getting your entire ETH slashed. And so that should be like, you basically need to calculate on an individual basis, because let's say one person is staking just regular ETH and then restaking, and there's another world in which you're just restaking to one ABS. They're still subject to the same exact slashing conditions on that ABS, despite one of them having a backstop and the other not. So if they are both basically under the conditions where they get slashed and they both get slashed the same amount. So for me, yeah, it doesn't make sense at all. You need to evaluate each based on their own individual risk characteristics.
I agree. But at the same time, like on the other hand, I would be incredibly surprised if we see even a single slashing incidence on an ABS over the course of the next 12 to 24 months. Like, I think you're going to see validators try and cover as many different ABSs as they possibly can in order to increase their yield, which ultimately is probably bad for the health of the Ethereum network. But at the end of the day, like, you're going to chase that yield. So I see both, I see both sides, although I do agree, like, at the end of the day, like, you should be compensated accordingly for the risk you're taking of being slashed.
Yeah, I just had another random thought too. Like, why is the amount of, like, attributable security I get denominated in ETH? Like, if ETH, like, 5x's, then I need to, like, assuming my token price doesn't move, I need to, like, 5x the amount of tokens that I need to pay out for a restake or two, receive like the same like percentage yield. And similarly, like in a bear market, right, like ETH and Bitcoin are probably the two assets that have the smallest drawdown, but my token's gonna like draw down like 90% while ETH drawdown's like 50% or whatever, and that means I need like double my emissions. Like, that seems slightly problematic, but that's not like a fully thought out thought yet.
Just do what Thorchain does and assume that your token is going to outperform Bitcoin or ETH in a bull market. Great tokenomics.
I've got one more thing on the news and governance updates that we just don't have written down here, but I did want to mention it. Echo launched last week by like invite code only, which is Kobe's new project that is basically just democratizing access to like seed round investing, essentially. So very cool platform. It's like all smart contract enabled. So you just send like, you know, USDC from your address, and then you get paid back the tokens in the address you sent, and there's vesting and stuff all on chain. So cool initiative. I actually don't know a ton about it. All I know is I try to do the KYC stuff that they go through, and I think Kobe's on his laptop somewhere around the world trying to figure out why my KYC didn't go through. So thank you, Kobe, for doing that. But yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on Echo as a whole.
He should be on the cool throne. I think my man's got banned from AngelList and was like, screw that, and making a Web3 for a crypto version of this. And who else better to do it than Kobe? He's probably on like the crypto Mount Rushmore of best CT influencers or best CT personnel ever. No like specific insightful thoughts on it. I mean, I'm really bullish on this idea of like democratizing capital allocation, of getting like private round allocation from normal people. That was one of the reasons why I personally got into crypto like back in 2017. Like, I love this idea of lowering the barriers of entry, get anyone the opportunity. Like, obviously we're seeing this play out in like the meme coin space, but with anyone can kind of hit on a lotto ticket and become a millionaire. But would love to see this in getting, you know, giving people access to invest in like legitimate projects early on. We got the ICO boom was the entire, like, that was the right way. We should have been doing this all along. And now we went the complete opposite way with projects going live at like $10 billion valuations or something ridiculous. And little people that don't have access to those private rounds are obviously getting shafted in the public, in the liquid markets once those token goes live. So overall, I mean, I commend Kobe for doing this. I hope it succeeds.
I'm going to be a bit cynical here. From like a builder or like a developer perspective, right? If I had the choice to raise between like just like retail and like democratizing that opportunity for retail versus raising from like KOLs or like VCs, I feel like I would actually still prefer to raise from like VCs or KOLs, because obviously those do provide like a pretty significant benefit at the end of the day, just from like a, even like just branding alignment or like amplification perspective. But like, if you're thinking about like raising from retail for like, oh, you know, like I'll get retail like financially aligned from like day one because they're going to be in my seed round, like, I don't think you need that, because if your project is exciting, like retail is going to come and farm your points anyway, even if they're not like invested in like your seed, series A, pre-seed, whatever round. And sure, I like the idea of like democratizing access and like investment opportunities to everyone, but I'm just trying to think from like a builder perspective why I would do it. And I'm not sure I have a fantastic answer yet, to be honest.
To me, I would say like, why not both, right? Like, today you kind of have to go, you know, have to go the VC route, but obviously that's a lot of what people do, VCs and KOLs. But actually, like, this allows people to this allows builders to do both at the same time. Get the big names on your cap table that are value add from the get-go while also giving, potentially democratizing the access to give smaller people the opportunity to get in as well. And I think having that like foundational bottoms up, it's like top down and bottoms up capital raising methodology. Like I think that it's gonna be really interesting to see how it plays out and how projects do once they launch off of like an echo round.
Yeah, I should also add to like the platform, once you go in there, it has like you can join different groups. So I don't know what would be stopping a large VC from like, you know, making a little group potentially with like five other top quality VCs. And then that's a closed group. And that's like an elite group you'd source funding from. Or maybe it's Ansem and he's a key, you know, KOL, obviously, which by the way, I learned like literally a week ago, that's key opinion leader. I didn't know that. There's like a new term in this week or in this space, like every single week. But I think it'd be good for him to be able to have like his top 1,000 followers who are involved with him and interact with him on Twitter. And then like, instead of him just going and shilling the product to people once it's on mainnet, they actually were in with him at the same exact price as they were prior. So I think the gated groups creates an interesting dynamic.
One quick thing. I actually thought KOL was a specific crypto term. My wife's in the pharmaceutical industry and she used it like 2 weeks into her new job. And she said KOL. I was like, wait, where'd you hear that term before? She's like, that's what they call it in my industry. I was like, oh, wow, that's completely new to me. Like, I always thought that was specifically like a crypto term for, you know, professional shiller, but apparently not.
That is funny. It's, yeah, I had a similar experience for TLDR like a year or two ago. My mom is in law and she said TLDR. And I was like, have you been listening to my podcast? And she was like, no, just too long didn't read. We use it in law all the time. I was like, oh, how about that? We got Hot Seat Cool Throne set up. Ren, why don't I kick it over to you for your Hot Seat or Cool Throne, I guess.
Yeah, this week, a little nerdy, a little technical, some MEV, Ethereum, order flow stuff. So first things first, this Titans integrated relay. So for those who aren't that familiar of what a relay is, it sort of sits between the proposer and the builder. The most famous relay is probably MEV Boost, but Titan is the largest non-censoring builder and they just launched a relay. But it's a little different from other existing relays. It only accepts blocks from their own builder and it doesn't send most of these blocks to other relays. So if that sounds like vertical integration to you, that's because it is vertical integration. When the relay is also the builder, then there effectively is no proposer builder separation, which was, I think, what a lot of Flashbot's work was basically trying to get rid of. And truth be told, I think someone would have done it sooner or later, especially in the face of blobs, the additional timing games that I think P2P started playing probably a few months ago. And like, blobs introduce additional latency into the blocks. And so having this like vertically integrated builder where you're able to decrease the time between block construction and block production is just like such an advantage, especially heading into like a bull market with increased on-chain activity. But yeah, this is about as vertically integrated as you can get. All you need is like some exclusive order flow, some like private RPC, and it's just like complete vertical integration. I don't think it's a great look for the Ethereum ecosystem, to be honest. And Data always has some great tweets. So definitely go check them out if you want a better rundown of what happened. But yeah, this Titan relay has an insane share of exclusive block flow. For example, Titan is at 84% this past week versus 49% for Bloxroute, 31% for Flashbots, 23% for Ultrasound. And I think one really interesting takeaway from this that it was like an opinion that I saw people had on Twitter was that Ethereum researchers and Ethereum Foundation don't talk to like the MEV people at all. And the MEV people don't talk to the Ethereum people at all. They're like both kind of building in their own world. And this has resulted like in some significant problems. It's like just like different job functions doing like the opposite of their job functions, you know. I don't know like long term where this goes to, or maybe like Ethereum has to break some form of like credible neutrality, but it'll be interesting to see how the community tackles this.
Wes, do you want to go as our MEV quant?
Yeah, I'll give it a go. But yeah, like to me, the sort of centralization of builders has been inevitable since the construction of the MEV Boost and Flashbots in general. I mean, we're already seeing this on like the builder searcher side of things where builders can see all the same transactions searchers can. So there's nothing stopping them from also becoming the best searchers and integrating. And we've seen that across the biggest builders. They have their own integrated searchers. They're either directly or teaming up with market makers themselves. So there's a lot of partnerships on that side of things. And now we're seeing sort of the other side of the coin where there's partnerships between builders and proposers. One of the reasons why, like, people argue this sort of breaks down PBS is that the whole point is that you're trusting a relay and not an individual builder, because the relay is able to get a bunch of different blocks, figure out which is the highest value, and give that to the proposer. So it just, it also like minimizes trust in general. And so as a result, the proposer now has to trust the individual builder. But I would argue that that in this current case may actually be a bigger benefit to the producer, specifically because, one, they have a pretty like steady stream of income or yield in this case, because they're probably getting paid directly from Titan. They're also like trusting in Titan's sophisticated ability to get to build the highest value block and a block that gets to them in time, because we're seeing a lot of failed blocks on the network currently, and in the past there have been bugs, etc. So it may actually be better for them to trust a highly sophisticated builder for a couple of reasons there. And yeah, I mean, I guess what Flashbots, MAV Boost, and PBS does is it at least showcases what's going on, so we can talk about it on a podcast and figure out why this, maybe this is wrong, or maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. Like, at least it's, you know, clarifying and making things transparent. But at the same time, you're sort of seeing things break down. And it's super interesting. There's a lot of cool conversations happening in the MBV space along these lines. And then you have completely opposite situation with Cheeto and what's going on in Solana, et cetera. So if you're an MBV nerd like I am, you're definitely like living right now. There's a lot to digest and learn about. But yeah, this is, to me, inevitable that you're going to see centralization at the builder level.
Westy, do you think it'd be fair to like point out, like, it feels like the MEV pie on Ethereum is more so like honestly shrinking than it is growing? Like, yes, we're kind of in a bull market and like on-chain activity is returning, but if you look at like the past 3 or 4 months, like, I don't think MEV is like skyrocketed or anything, because it feels like a lot of this meme coin trading is happening on Solana or maybe other activities going to L2s. Like, do you think the fact that the MEV pie seems to be kind of going the wrong direction in terms of growth, like, makes the centralization problem worse because the incentive to extract the MEV isn't really growing? Like, I don't know. That's kind of a weird question, but
I think it is a fair question of like, what is the future of MEV on the L1, given that a lot of transactions value we're already seeing going to L2s. There has been a push from the Ethereum Foundation, specifically Justin Drake, for base rollups, where the L1 is actually sequencing for these rollups. And if that kind of feature takes off, you're going to see, I think, MEV value come back to the base layer, because it will be the sequencer for a lot of these rollups. But at the same time, that's a lot of value that the L2s themselves are going to want to capture. So I doubt that they just hand that off willingly, although that a lot of these Ethereum rollups are, you know, completely aligned with Ethereum. And if a lot of rollups start to buy in, again, we've talked about shared sequencing in the past, if you get a lot of buy-in from a lot of rollups, then it becomes more valuable for the next rollup to join, etc. So if they gain traction, you could see that. But the way things are currently going, it does look like the value of MEV on the L1 is shrinking. But then you're going to see more sophisticated games at the L2 level, depending on how the rollup like integrates its sequencer, whether it's first come, first serve, or they have some sort of PBS auction. Like, it's going to be interesting to see the different dynamics across different rollups, but that's definitely a trend I'm looking at, yeah.
I think just following up on the L2 discussion, I think MEV eventually comes to L2s, even if it hasn't. I just saw an interesting tweet this morning, which was that Base had one of the nodes running like an old version of a client, and it had its like P2P mempool like public for like a few weeks, which is honestly pretty ridiculous, to be honest. I feel like there was some other version of this like half a year ago, but I forgot which L2 it was. But it just sounded really familiar. And so, I mean, like, MEV is definitely happening. And with like Arbitrum's time boost, I don't know when that's going live, but that kind of feels like kind of like priority transaction inclusion. If you like pay a bit more, there's like a bit like there's a bit of nuance to it. Like it's a bit like fairer than just like the whoever has the highest priority fee gets faster transaction inclusion. But I feel like it's inevitable that MEV like appears everywhere. It's just like, what route do you want to take to mitigate it? I think even if you like make a decision that like just kills like MEV opportunities out there, like eventually the market will find a way if it gets big enough.
Yeah, I think that's a good take, Ren.
But I think another quick hot seat, or not really a hot seat for me, to be honest, more like a neutral seat, is MEV Blocker. So MEV Blocker is Cowsoft's sort of like private RPC product. They launched this with a few other partners. I can't remember off the top of my head. I think it was like Beaver Build maybe. And then basically they're going to turn on the fee switch for this. It's going to be a fixed amount per block won. The amount is updated monthly, and it's a fraction of the average per block value of MEV Blocker transactions during the previous month. As of right now, the initial fee will be roughly 20% of the value of the average per block value of exclusive MEV Blocker transactions. And then that's going to be split 50-50 between the DAO and MEV Blocker partners. So MEV Blocker users won't be affected by the fee. The fee is very much more so for any builders that are connected to MEV Blocker and it's Relay. And like so far, just from the numbers and analysis that they've done, it seems like a relatively low fee. There are some nuances there though, because it's like an average fee. It's not calculated on a per block basis. And I think that makes sense, just given that it would introduce too much like latency within the Relay. But yeah, this only really becomes a problem when all builders have blocks of very low value. So imposing a fee turns the value of winning negative. And I think it'll be interesting to see, like, there's this, right, which is like monetizing and turning on a fee switch for like some MEV mitigation solution. And on the other hand, you have like Gito, which just killed his mempool and like kind of quote unquote like turned off like a fee switch generated from the mempool. They still make money from like atomic bundles and the other components of its block engine. But it'll be interesting to just watch and monitor like the social reaction, I guess, to like monetizing like any MEV component or like MEV infra.
I think, and I'm not 100% sure, but last I was checking in on this on CowSwap and the Cow protocol in general, I believe this fee is paid at the end of each month, like Ren said, based on the trailing month's average per block value of MEV Blocker transactions. And it's actually paid by the builders retroactively in Cow. So they use the ETH rewards by Cow, which has absolutely horrendous liquidity on chain. And then that's, you know, 50% return to the builder and, or sorry, the partners of MEV Blocker, which is essentially the builders. And then 50% to the DAO is like pretty much protocol and liquidity. So I think it's interesting from the perspective of the Cow token, because historically they just haven't focused on value accrual there at all. And even just like a fixed bid of 5 to 10 ETH a day could actually go like a very long way on those liquidity pools.
Yeah, I agree there. But I think that's a good point to kick it over to you, Sam, for your hot seat or cool throne.
Yes, I have got airdrops in the cool throne. Now, this is going to air on Wednesday, so unfortunately we will miss like the fun PA after we get W and Ina on Wednesday and Tuesday, respectively. But Ina is trading at around a $9 billion FDV, and W is trading at around a $17 billion FDV in pre-launch futures markets. But there's very minimal volume on these in open interest, so take those with a grain of salt as usual. But nonetheless, that's, no matter how you slice it, going to be a multi-billion dollar stimulus package hitting various EOAs on Ethereum. So Athena as well is starting a Sats campaign in lieu of introducing Bitcoin as a collateral type. And they noted in the announcement that on average, there's been about $25 billion of open interest at an average of 22% positive funding rates throughout 2024 thus far. So that's about $3 billion paid out to shorts, which is pretty wild. And they currently have 15% of ETH perp global open interest, and funding has remained north of, you know, 40-50% for most of the year. So safe to say they're absolutely printing on that one and are very eager to get more collateral. But yeah, so big airdrops coming. And then on top of that, you have DGEN, which I know pretty much everyone on the team fumbled a bag at one point of that. And they have airdrop to Checker Live, which basically rewards people who are posting on Warpcast and other Farcaster, I guess, client front ends. And that thing's run to over a $2 billion valuation. So that airdrop started out as pretty irrelevant, but now is actually becoming quite relevant. And just a fun caveat on that one, too. One Confirmation, I believe it was, bought $1 million of DGEN like 2 months ago, and that is now worth like $100 million. So they hit a nice 100x in about 2 months on this one. So hat tip to those guys over there. I wish wish I had that kind of conviction. Another interesting caveat on DGEN is Farcaster set an all-time high in daily active users yesterday with over 70,000 daily active users, which honestly, I'm just rooting for Farcaster in general. I like decentralized social. I think it's a cool primitive within crypto, so I was happy to see that. But on the same topic of airdrops, we've got Parcel, which is coming soon. Maybe, Ren, you can share some information about that when I'm done talking here. And then Tensor, I believe, is coming soon as well. Couldn't locate the actual hard dates for those, but I believe those are expected in April. Ordinals Enjoyers got airdropped. They've gotten plenty of stuff, but most recently they got the Runestone, which is that community-driven Ordinals project that will eventually deliver runes, and those are trading at 0.05 Bitcoin or about $3,000-$5,000 floor, depending on the day of where Bitcoin's trading at. And it's becoming more common to airdrop to NFT projects. So we've seen Bad Kids, Miladies, Penguins, Mad Lads, etc., get airdropped different things throughout the course of 2024, which is a bit of a new meta, but interesting nonetheless. So yeah, I mean, airdrop farmers in 2023 definitely had a good year between, I think it was Blur, as well as Vertex was another good one, probably missing a few here. But regardless, 2024 looks to be shaping up to be even bigger for airdrop farmers, which is something I wouldn't have predicted. I guess I missed Jito there. I think Jito is at the end of 2023, so that one was pretty huge. But nevertheless, it just never ceases to amaze me how much money just gets like dropped to people in this market. It's absolutely bonkers. So Cool Throne is definitely the airdrop farmers, but not sure if you guys have any thoughts here.
Just super quickly on Parcel, 7.5% of the supply is going to be distributed across Parcel points holders. 0.4% of that is going to the NFT members, and 0.1% of the token supply is going to Madlets. I wonder if for protocols with like a NFT collection, like Parcel, Tensor, how much they're going to give to the NFT collection. Because, you know, to be honest, like if I bought an NFT for a protocol that gives me like a points boost or something, I don't think I would have expected to like get any of the token supply, like specifically for the NFT collection. So I think that's something interesting to see. And I think another interesting thing is like with Parcel, Blast, Athena, you're seeing a lot more, or like maybe even Etherfi, like you're seeing a lot more attention and focus being placed on the season that's post the TGE, rather than like basically like all of like the airdrop happening like pre-TGE, which I think makes sense, just given like a bull market and the opportunities available. And like Athena, like that 6 week period from starting the airdrop like program to TGE is like pretty electric. And I do think that timelines will compress as we head into a bull market. Like just people will want more instant gratification. Another thing about Farcaster, I think they announced something super cool over the weekend. I'm blanking on the name, but it was like dynamic frames or something. Like you can interact with a frame, and then like depending on how you interact with it, like the UI of the frame will actually change. So it's not like a static frame. And I think like once again, that opens up like a bunch of opportunities and possibilities. I'm not too in tune with the Farcaster ecosystem, but I'm sure there's like a lot of cool apps being built there right now.
Yeah, I think a lot of these teams are looking at the success of recent airdrops, EtherFi being one of those, Jupiter being another, which is about to flip Celestia in value. Like they're seeing how well these new tokens are doing, and I think they finally see like it's time to drop the token because we're in a very positive environment. People like the new and shiny thing. And so, yeah, we're going to see a lot of them lined up. You mentioned a bunch of them, but like, in particular, Solana is going to get a very big like stimulus check, basically, to a lot of their users, in the same way that Jito in the fall sort of was a catalyst for a lot of growth within I guess, like the meme coin sector and other AI DeFi coins within Solana. Like W is going to be one of the biggest airdrops of all time. Definitely one of the biggest this cycle. And so it's going to be a lot of value being dropped to Solana users that they're definitely going to go and use to speculate on other things. So I'm curious to see how these airdrops affect the ecosystem, what people are going to be bidding with their newfound capital, how well these assets trade. Yeah, I'm pretty excited overall.
Yeah, I'm just, it's mind-boggling, quite honestly. Like, I can't wrap my head around the fact that it's multi-billion dollar airdrop season. it's super crazy. So, and I also find like the valuations really interesting. Like, we've seen Jupe perform incredibly well since getting launched, and people were dancing on the grave like 2 months ago. And the same goes with Jito. I think Jito is like pretty close to all-time highs right now. So like the post TGE slash airdrop price action has actually been surprisingly strong. So it definitely makes you like think, you know, is this something we should actually dump, or is this something you should hold? Like ENA in particular is interesting to me, just because like the sheer amount of revenue they generate. And I know that's like a complete meme in a bull run, but like we're talking like, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue at a dApp layer from two asset carry slash basis trades is like basically what we're looking at here by the end of 2024. So definitely a cool time to be in crypto at the dApp layer.
All right. I think that's a good point to throw to Westy for his hot seat Kuthon. And as a side note, holy shit, I did not realize Jupiter was trading at $16.5 billion at DV. What? But sorry, Westy, go ahead.
Yeah, it's insane. But yeah, I've blasted on the hot seat. So basically, there's a NFT collection called Munchables that was seeing exponential growth on Blast. And they suffered an exploit to the tune of roughly $62 million at the time. Zach XBT, alongside some use of vulgar language against the exploiter, uncovered how it happened. Basically, the team hired four developers that all referred each other, found out that it's actually just one dev in North Korea who was able to basically siphon the funds to himself. Zach and some other security researchers were able to somehow recover the private keys containing the funds and return it back to the protocol. So in the end, everything turned out fine. But prior to that happening, there was a huge discussion within the Blast community and crypto Twitter as a whole of whether or not Blast should roll back the chain to before the hack. And you basically had two camps. One would argue you should never compromise the bridge or roll back the chain at all, because you remove all credibility, any pretense of decentralization is out the window, but you retain user funds. Yeah. On the other hand, you have like the other camp that saw, okay, you have a bunch of huge investors that are bought into the ecosystem. Obviously, you need to get their money back so they can continue to stimulate growth. And obviously, like the decentralization theater is just that, it's theater. Like every sophisticated actor using Blast already knows that it's not decentralized whatsoever. It's governed by a small multisig, et cetera. So you're not really saving anything. You might as well get the money back, et cetera. And I definitely saw a lot of points from both camps. If you were to ask me, like, I definitely think they, at least at the time, should have rolled back the chain. Like that should have been the move if they were choosing between these two options. Simply based on the fact that, the decentralization theater doesn't really matter. Like what really matters is the users, that you retain them, and you might lose some credibility on that front. But if you don't get the funds back, you lose credibility on making sure your users are whole and okay, et cetera. So I don't know if you guys have any views on this situation or Blast as a whole.
Yeah, I saw some good takes on this on Twitter last week. And I think that it can basically be summarized with, you don't want to fund North Korea's missile program. And I know like people were talking at one point about maybe this was like a actual, like a French citizen. So I don't know actually if it was proven to be a North Korean, but with that being said, like like Pac-Man would probably be held liable directly in court for like funding North Korea. So I really don't think this was ever actually a conversation. I think at the end of the day, this chain was getting rolled back if the keys weren't recovered. So I'm glad to see the keys are recovered and we didn't actually have to see this get played out, to be completely honest. But with that being said, I think we all know how this would have gone had it not.
I just can't take anything that's launching on Blast seriously, to be honest. Like, that's really my overall take. And it's not even just Blast too. It's like the newest AMM that launched on DGen chain over the weekend. It's like, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. Like, maybe I'll like throw like a couple bucks in and try to gamble. But I mean, people that are willing to throw like risk to, caution to the wind and just like ape into something without really knowing what it is. I guess it kind of is the market right now. It's like ape first, ask questions later. And I can definitely sympathize with that. I think that a little bit myself, but I think as it refers to Blast, like why are you building there? What are you doing? Like, there's so many other good opportunities. If you're actually a true builder that cares about distribution of your product, you've been launching on Base, Optimism, or Arbitrum today. Like, there's really no other option. I think if you're building on Blast, I think you're doing it for the clout and for a get rich quick scheme. So I, you know, not to shit on developers that are truly trying to build unique, innovative products on Blast, but it's like, I'm never going to be using your product just for like the location that you're building your application on. That's my personal take. And yeah, that's really how I feel.
I'll be excited to get a renewed take after that token launches. I bet that narrative changes drastically.
It'll be a hated rally for sure. Like, it'll pump in my face. I'm still not going to touch it, but yeah.
Yeah, Blast has been, in terms of like what was expected, like one of the worst launches of L2s, because there's seemingly a big rug every day of like the first week of the chain launching. And I think we had a lot of takes before launch of they were able to attract so much capital and we're giving them props. And like, if you're a developer, you obviously want to see traction before you build anywhere. And like with that, you're probably going to attract good developers. But I think in hindsight, like looking back, I think a lot of the builders that were enticed by the big numbers were like opportunists and people looking to exploit, as opposed to people looking to like actually build good products. And yeah.
Color me shocked.
Yeah. I mean, obviously in hindsight, it looks pretty obvious. And I tried to warn that like developers are going to see that number and you're going to see a lot of like rugs, et cetera. I didn't think there'd be the amount that there was, where basically every big token ended up rugging. But yeah, I mean, like Sam said, once the token launches and the fact that we've sort of gotten all the, I guess, the bad news and bad actors out of the way, that Blast may start to come into its own. You're going to start to see the developers that are here for the long term stick around. And there's still a bunch of capital over there, you know, ready to play with applications. They're a little more cautious now and ready to play with apps they can actually use. So like, hopefully we see a comeback from Blast, especially as the token launches. But again, with effort, I'm not touching that stuff until I see some confirmation of like good stuff going on.
To be honest, I think that they're getting a bit too much shit, actually. Like, if you think about the early days of like Ethereum, like there had to be like so many like 9-fig bugs. And like even Solana today, there's probably like 5 tokens being launched a second that are like immediately rugged for like a few K here and there. I don't think like it's any different from like in any other like blockchain today. They're just getting a lot of spotlight because they launched with like the whole like, you know, like, or like a casino sort of like marketing, and that's where their branding came from. But you know, like every other ecosystem will have like a huge amount of bugs, especially in the early day. And like, as far as like the trust assumptions for Blast itself, like it really isn't that different from like half of the L2s out there today. But obviously, like if you're bridging into Blast, like you should know like kind of what you're bridging into, whereas for like other chains, like a slightly more like obfuscated.
Yeah, and like on that topic, like if I was someone looking to do like a malicious protocol slash like token launch and like rug people, like I'd be going to Base. everyone is signing anything over there. Like everyone's on Farcast or just minting different stuff. Like no one's looking or thinking twice. There's a million things to do. And it's actually a lot of fun to go play over there. But I just kind of wonder if that centralized sequencer operated by a US entity really is like kind of what's keeping people away. Cause as we just discussed, we think they would have rolled back the chain if need be, or at least like gated funds from exiting the bridge.
But all right, enough about Blast. Last but not least, Effort Capital, who you got on the hot seat, Kutron?
Yeah, I actually think I put it on the hot seat like a month or so ago at the peak price, but BitTensor is on the hot seat. So it's down about 40% from all-time highs. Granted, rest of the market is down like decent amount, depending on you know, I guess overall markets, most things are down 10-20%-ish. Specifically over the past week, but BitTensor took like a pretty hard fall. I'm just going to repeat what I said last time, which is I still think I've read every single paper out there. By no means am I an AI expert. I far from it. I'm still trying to learn like all about like the entire space, but I just collectively, I keep thinking like it's all just mumbo jumbo. I've read every single document out there. I've read people's understanding of what BitTensor and how Tau works and its distribution mechanism of its inflation to generate like better inference and better training and pre-training of models. It's going to like eat the world. It's going to beat OpenAI at its own game. And I'm just convinced that like nobody knows how it works and that it's really just an AI narrative on top of VE tokenomics. I know they're trying to create like a new dynamic Tau like token model that changes how it distributes Tau inflation, but I still think it's like a fundamentally broken mechanism. The reason why it's really on the hot seat, I think, is not just the price action, but Eric Wall posted like this really lengthy bear post, effectively saying like it should go to zero. It's a bunch of hot garbage. It's really like there's nothing AI or there's no like, you know, magic dust that BitTensor does specifically for like this decentralized AI narrative. Pretty much called like a 1,000x less efficient ChatGPT bot, which is like for specifically from one of the largest subnets. I think subnet one on BitTensor. And he really summarized it. Like it doesn't really necessarily incentivize competition or optimize model output. It's effectively just like incentivizing people to come up with the exact same responses and really copy one another's responses. And it's really just like effectively, like it's a wrapper on top of OpenAI and ChatGPT and like other open source models out there. I mean, that's really like the only thing I really wanted to talk about it. I think in general, that doesn't mean to say like it's not going to hit all-time highs again. I'm sure it will. I do think that the decentralized AI narrative is still really early on. Obviously this is not financial advice. It is still like considered one of like the blue chip AI tokens. I think I'm really excited to see like Ritual and other AI related plays like launch and become liquid assets to trade in the coming quarters. But I'm personally very bearish on BitTensor in the long run. I really just think it's paying out like $1.5 to $2 billion a year at this point in new tokens. Now you got to ask yourself, like out of 10 billion FTV or whatever it is now, like, is there actually going to be net demand for this? BitTensor bulls will say there is, because there's like huge demand to grow new sub or build new subnet architecture. But like, if you listen to, there's a Twitter space that Martin Shkreli hosted over the weekend, or I think it might've actually been Friday. Const, who's the founder of BitTensor, came on to try to explain to Martin, who's also a pretty big like BitTensor bear, I guess you could say, explain like why BitTensor is better, why Martin, who's actually building a AI startup supposedly, like why he should leverage BitTensor to like lower his operating costs to fine tune and train and like provide inference for his model. And to me, and I think to a lot of other people in the spaces, it was really just like, again, a bunch of mumbo jumbo that really didn't make sense. It went over a lot of people's heads. I'm just, you know, I'm not bearish on decentralized AI, far from it. I just don't think that BitTensor is anything that's cracked up to be. But again, I'm sure the narrative will stick and it'll still do well. But it was really interesting seeing like a lot of non-Web3 focused VCs kind of jump on the bandwagon to this AI narrative, probably because they missed NVIDIA. And then they saw crypto being like this high beta play on traditional equities. And they like, the first thing they jumped into was like BitTensor and how Tau is going to like revolutionize the world. But I don't even think they fully understand like what it does. So yeah, that's my hot seat.
Yeah, I mean, likewise, I'm not going to pretend to be an AI expert, very, very far from it. I know like the correct words to say to sound smart, just say like verifiable inference, provenance, and like ZKML, and you sound like you really know your shit in AI. I mean, like, I do think in the end state that there is a lot of like utility in building like AI systems on like distributed like blockchains. But there are also some projects which like did not need to be a BitTensor subnet, and you see them like say, hey, we're gonna launch a BitTensor subnet, and like it's pretty obvious that the financial incentives are there. Like, I don't really blame anyone for trying to make money. But did it really need to be a BitTensor subnet for like some of these like data subnets? Like, probably not. But yeah, I mean, like long term, I'm still like a crypto X AI bull.
Okay, now it's my turn to LARP as an AI expert. So the way that a lot of these models like learn or get better is through like reinforcement learn, like I forget the term for it, but basically
Our RLHF, like
RL, yeah, exactly, RLHF.
we're all LARPing today. I love it.
It's great. Where basically you have humans come in and say whether a response was good, bad, etc. And you actually give it feedback. And the way that BitTensor tries to do this is in a decentralized way, where you have each basically validator run their own LLM, and how close they are to the response, they either get like positive or negative feedback, I believe in the form of rewards. And that model is obviously like way less performant than the other one, because basically what you're incentivizing is for each validator to be as close to the average or what they think everyone else is going to say, not what the actual real response is. Because if they give the real response and everyone else gives some sort of like response that's adjacent, well, then they're going to get penalized. So they, it's not the right basically incentive mechanism to actually have RLHF like type models where you're actually learning and getting better. So that's like the one thing I do know about BitTensor, and that like it's underperforming in that way, but I don't know enough to talk about like other subnets, like what's going on the cutting edge and whether they can compete with open source. But on that specific metric, like I'm definitely a bear, but I need to learn more for sure.
Speaking about RLHF, we've said that acronym a lot already in the past 5 minutes, but Ryan Connor, new Blockverse research analyst, wrote like a banger report on HiveMapper and said that like it kind of is like a AI adjacent play because they use RLHF to optimize I guess how the camera is able to map certain street signs and what have you. So really good report. Hopefully Blockverse research subscribers already seen it. If you haven't read it but want to read like probably the best report on HiveMapper in the space, suggest you subscribe. Ryan is gonna be like our DPIN and an AI expert for the foreseeable future. So really excited to see what content he puts out. But really never thought of it like that because I vaguely understand like how HiveMapper worked prior to that. But seeing his report kind of opened up my eyes like the potential of what they're trying to achieve.
Yep, big agree on that. I read the report, edited it. It's very good. Highly recommend you check it out. On top of that, we have a podcast coming out next Thursday with Ritual, which is an AI project. It's really interesting, actually. I'm like an AI skeptic, so I'm going to save you guys the I guess spiel on BitTensor specifically because I think I've given it here before. But nonetheless, stay tuned for that one coming out next week. But I think that's a good spot to stop, Ren, unless you have anything else. Nope, nada. All right, Westy, effort. Thanks for coming on. We will see you here next week.